सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू रिटर्न टू वन ऑफ आवर फेवरेट सब्जेक्ट्स एज वी हैव टॉक्ड अबाउट इकोनॉमिक ग्रोथ इन द कंट्री एंड वी हैव लर्न्ड फ्रॉम पीपल लाइक आतिफ मियां एंड मेनी अदर पीपल दैट इंस्टीट्यूशंस आर extremely important for growth. And in Pakistan, the biggest problem, as we've discussed often, is governance. So today we are going to discuss governance and especially civil service reform. And to discuss this, I've got a very eminent academic from Pakistan, Dr. Saeed Shafkat. Dr. Saeed Shafkat has a PhD from Columbia. He's worked in as a civil servant in many parts, retired as a secretary. He's held too many jobs for me to count. But after retirement, Dr. Saeed Shafkat did not give up. He has established a Center for Public Policy and Governance in FC College, University, Lahore, which is a very well-functioning center. Lots of good things are happening here. I've come here very often and I've learned a lot from Dr. Saeed Shafkat's writings. He has written a lot on civil service reform. So today we're going to engage in a wide-ranging discussion on governance and civil service reform. So Dr. Saab, welcome to Soch Bichar.
Nadeem, thank you so much. It is always a pleasure to see you, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And you yourself are such a prolific writer on economic growth, social and political and economic reform. And I'm very pleased that we are having this conversation.
Thank you, Dr. Saab.
Let me make two corrections. Sure. Number one, I did my PhD at UPenn, University of Pennsylvania. Okay.
Even better.
And I taught at Columbia for almost I would say 9 years or so, off and on. And I have not been a civil servant, but I was fortunate to train civil servants because I was at the Civil Services Academy. Okay. And I joined there as an academic, and I was, for a long time chief instructor and also warden of the hostels, and had a very, very interesting time.
So my mistake. That's why I thought you were a civil servant. Yeah. Mistake. So, tell me now. I'm glad. Thank you for those corrections. Those very important corrections. UPenn is a lovely university. It's one of the best universities in the world. And incidentally, my daughter just graduated from there. But let's move on. Dr. Saab, tell me. First of all, introduce us to your Center for Public Policy and Governance.
Yeah, Center for Public Policy and Governance is a very interesting kind of a setup. Mm-hmm. It was initiated at FC College in 2007, and that it has been 10 years. And they have been very, very productive. In many ways challenging, but equally exciting in some ways. And the reason why I say this is that we were able to initiate a program initially in 2009, and it took me 2 years to develop the course and program. And I made a pitch for an evening program, which is Executive Masters in Public Policy. And the idea was that we would like to target the mid-career professionals, particularly the Punjab government officials. And we were able to do that. So when we started, the basic concern was that we should have only 10 to 15 students. Since it's an evening program, people who are working, they are the ones who should be really coming in. And that is how the program started. And then after a couple of years, we also began to realize, or at least I thought, if we really want to develop a public policy center and focus on governance, one of the challenge is, doing some research on this. And for research, you have to think in terms of funding. So I, conversed with the university. Is it really possible to think in terms of building a library and also a research program? Of course, the answer was that it is difficult. We do not have funding for that. So then we began to explore what are the possibilities for seeking funding from outside. And of course, this was a period, particularly 2007 to 2010, was a period when DFID, USAID, UNFPA, Open Society, the many were keen and were seeing some change because in Pakistan the situation was changing, by 2007, 2008 the prospects of elections were likely. Therefore, for softer programs, research funding became available, and we began to sort of pitch, projects and see if we
could. So, how many students do you have now?
Right now, we have two programs running at this point. Mm-hmm. One is the executive master's, which is the older program. Right. For mm-hmm. that, we have between 10 to 15 is the normal take that we have. Mm-hmm. So currently, we have about 10 students, and about 40 have graduated, out of which almost 25 are from the the government of Punjab, their offices. Right. And the second program is a MPhil program that we started in 2014. Mm-hmm. And currently, this is our fourth batch. And mm-hmm. at this batch, we have about 16 students.
Not bad.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So mm-hmm. it's.
And you have a PhD student as well?
We are planning on PhD, launching PhD in 2018. Okay. That's how we are. We have taken time.
And how many teaching staff, researchers do you have?
Yeah, that's a good question. Currently, we have six faculty, out of those six, five are PhDs from abroad. Two have a master's degree from abroad, and that way it's a relatively small faculty.
It's a very interesting center that has been created. I would encourage more students to come to you.
Yeah, that would be good.
But Oksab, tell me now, let's turn to deeper issues of governance and civil service reform. You've been working on this all your life. As you said, you were also a trainer in the Civil Service Academy. Can you please tell us what you think are the key issues in governance in this country?
That's a very good question. Number one, I tend to take governance as a cultural issue, mm-hmm. and there has to be a distinction drawn between the government and governance. Government is more institutional. Governance is cultural in the sense that it's more than one groups and their interactions. Okay. And in particular, when we began to really look at this, we realized that culture does play a very important role. And when I say culture, it is the institutional culture that matters. It is the culture of the society that matters. It is a culture in and around in terms of how do we conduct our businesses, how do we conduct our work with government. So therefore, one needs to really have a deeper understanding of that. And it is in that context that when you began to see how bureaucracy should be developed, then the critical question is that if you want to retain, cultivate, sustain democracy without a professionally competent bureaucracy, you cannot really have that. So in that sense, governance raises this another issue. Mm-hmm. And that issue is political order more important, or is democratic setup more important? And that is also raising a different kind of challenge today. When you look at China, from their perspective, political stability, political order is now the key. And therefore, economic growth and development has followed. In societies like ours, on one side, we are, unable to reform the cultural dimension. And on the other side, we have not been able to pay adequate attention to recognize and make a case why bureaucracies and developing bureaucracies and improving their efficiency and professional skills is important. Mm-hmm. So that is the kind of key concern. So in this context, the key issue is really redefining the political leadership and political parties' relationship with the bureaucracy at the top level, so that you can minimize some degree of politicization, and you recognize the sanctity of institutions. Mm-hmm. And that is something which is a major challenge when you began to think in terms of how do you go about civil service reform. So my contention is...
That's very interesting. Yeah. So what you're basically saying, which I think is very interesting way of looking at it, very interesting perspective, that we should not think of governance in a very traditional setting where we think of fixing this or that here, we try and fix the education sector or this sector or that sector. What you're saying is we should take a more holistic view of governance, and we should think of governance in a certain political setting and how the relationship of that political setting with the governance structures such as the bureaucracy are. Now, how would you operationalize that in terms of...
That's very very good, and you have it really right. And that's the kind of relationship which is the tougher and the most difficult relationship. So if we are looking at our own context, the basic reason why I say without political reform, no reform of bureaucracy is really possible. So that means we have to look from within. And that means political parties need to reform themselves in terms of thinking through that without democratizing political parties, you cannot have democracy.
Fair point.
So when you're thinking of democracy, you have to think in terms of tolerance, accommodation, bargain, compromise, and more importantly, the normative dimension of respecting dissent, which is one of the key concerns. That also means that we need to recognize that Pakistan is a pluralistic society where there are more than one languages, more than one religions, more than one ethnicities, and therefore the cultural dimension becomes very important. As you look at this, then you have to ask yourself, well, you know, for this, a particular kind of a civil service was created by the British. Over a period of time, things have changed, and we have moved towards a democracy, which when the British created the civil service, that civil service was not meant for working under a bureaucratic, under
Very
a democratic order. You see, so that is another challenge. So there has to be a recognition on both sides, on the side of political leadership and political parties, and on the side of bureaucracy and bureaucratic institutions. And here, no reform is likely to succeed in bureaucracy and improving governance unless there is a change from within the bureaucracy, that the bureaucracy realizes that these are some of the things that we need to really change and reform. From outside, we can always suggest, and we have suggested, yet the ownership has not really come into existence. So, for any meaningful reform, those who have to be reformed, they have to sort of accept that reform is a desirable goal for improving their working performance and, of course, their career.
There has to be ownership of reform.
Ownership.
You're absolutely correct. But, Oksa, the fundamental problem then is for people like us, right? And my audience, I hope, the thinking community. I'm doing this more for the students and researchers than the general media. What I'd like you to turn towards now is let me rephrase that. I think one thing that I learned through history is that the way reform happens, for example, I'll take you back to something like, let's say, how the civil service came into being in the U.S. or in Britain, for example, right? I mean, they developed those civil services, as far as I remember, mainly as a reaction to, for example, US particularly, to the reaction to the corruption in the political system that led to the development of the civil service, independent civil service in the US. I think it was the Morrill Act or something that did it in 80, or Pendleton, I forget now. But it was a certain act that was passed in 1870 to create the civil service. The British civil service was given similar independence from the political system because they felt that's the way to go. But before that, there was a whole series of intellectual debates that led this to happen. Would you say that our research community, our thinking community has not played enough of a role in motivating the civil service reform? And if so, what should they be working on?
That's a very important point that you're raising, and I hate to say this, but my own sense is that our academic community, our research community, has had little understanding of how government works, and we have made little effort. In fact, the attitude of the bureaucrat and civil servant in general has also been that given the historical baggage, that since they were trained and brought in a way that they will be highly paid, you know, when you look at the ICS, highly paid, they are over and above the cultural situation, who understand but would not like to shake the culture. They will try to be fair, just, and you know, honest, which was some of the very key attributes and characteristics of the ICS. So as independence came, that began to dilute. So if one is really thinking in terms of, you know, how should one really go about looking at this, then you have to really once again look at the internal circumstances and look at the bureaucracy from within. What is it that we did in terms of you know, how the civil servant should be recruited? What was the role of the Public Service Commission? So in that sense, if I were to make a case, I would say, you know, again, as academics, as researchers, we have done little to really see how the recruitment process takes place. Recently there has been some trend, but it is still in a very infancy phase. So the effort has to be now that from both the side of bureaucracy and as well as from the side of academia, that unless there is a bridge building, unless there is a deeper understanding of how the government works, and given media globalization, now it is no longer possible to really work through the old ways of you know, keeping everything secret. You know, before you do that, everything is on the net in one form or the other. So one has to sort of really recognize that there is a need in terms of developing a change in attitude. And that takes time. And therefore, we need to have a better understanding of how provincial and federal aspects of government really work. And this is something which is, to my mind, again, one of the reasons why we have begun to see the rise of these public sector.
Another problem.
Yeah.
We have, as the British left for us, I think, for a start, let's think about it. We have still have a colonial civil service. We have not really reformed it, right? Although there was a Bhutto reform. But the Bhutto reform really did not break the colonial tradition as much. Let me first begin by asking you about the. You've done a lot of work on this. Let's talk about the history of the civil service reform.
That's a very good question. You're absolutely right that yes, the colonial structure continues to exist. Under Bhutto, there was a radical departure. But part of the difficulty has been that that reform was done in haste, was inadequately thought through. There was less preparation for, you know, how are we going to you know, institutionalize the nature of that reform that we were trying to introduce, and again, the academic input at that time was also very limited. So there was not a you know, as you said earlier, there was not a serious consultative process or a debate on really how the reform will unfold and how will we go about sustaining it. And therefore, what you began to see was that this reform was seen by the most powerful group, which was the CSP then, the Civil Service of Pakistan then. They thought that this was basically undermining the power and privilege and perks of the CSP. So that was one part. The second part was that in some ways it was equally important because there was pay differentials, which were again sort of removed, and you began to see the rise of 1 to 22 grades. So, you know, and that raised another issue that at the level where it mattered in terms of merit, professionalism, and to some degree professionalization of different cadres, you began to treat all equally. So that way it became a kind of a concern. But one of the good things that happened as a consequence of that 73 reform was this common training program. As a result of this, now, as I see it today, this is perhaps one of the few institutions in the country where for a relatively short period of time, although the training during the common training program used to be, once you got the CSS done, it used to be about 9 months. And it has varied over a period of time. It has come to 6 months, but you could see fresh recruits from across the country, from Sindh, Balochistan, KP, Punjab, and of course Gilgit-Baltistan. So for a relatively short period of time, they all began to interact and see each other. The second important part was that from very early on, within that campus, you began to see all 12 services, irrespective of the fact that those who are in DMG and others who are on merit, they are all equal. And that was another, within the CTP, there was a different kind of a competition. But that again, since not enough attention was paid in terms of how do you really sustain this, improve the instructional quality, therefore, it has not had impact. And it is rather unfortunate that in civil service, training is not valued. Unless we put value on training, professionalism in the civil services is likely to remain.
Why would you say training is not valued? From the way I understand it, civil servants have to undergo training at the beginning, then between each grade, even 18, 19 now, 19 to 20, 20 to 21. So almost at each, before each promotion, they have to get training. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But that's a very recent phenomenon that happened between 2005 and onwards. And still, the issue is, what are the contents of the training? And for that, and who are the trainers? Mm-hmm. So unless there is a master trainer is motivated.
Please explain that. Many of trainer, us don't understand.
Yeah.
You're saying the trainers and the content.
Trainers have to be those who believe and, have served either in the service or have sufficient background knowledge, understanding of how the public service really works and why public service is important. Public service is a calling. It's an honor. It's something which you are doing to, and you've chosen a professor. You have chosen a profession to do good for the public. Unfortunately, what has happened is that we have begun to see it is self-serving public service. No service is done as far as public is concerned. So on one side, you are absolutely right that yes, for each grade, they have instituted training. And this training is basically still for the higher civil services of Pakistan, which means the CSS services. Now, there is a small segment that you in each you see from other cadres and other groups. But largely, it is primarily for the federal civil service, which is the CSS service. Now, since we are on training, I want to give you the other side of the training too. I tend to see, and that's why I said governance is a cultural issue. We have not paid adequate attention to what I call the street level bureaucrat. The street level bureaucrat is your patwari, is your SHO, is your income tax inspector, and in some ways, even a school teacher. These are very important positions which are between...
I would also include the civil judges.
The civil judges and session judges, you are absolutely right. So if you look at this, these are, 1 to 16 grade, and the question that you have is the first respondents of the state are these. Before you reach a deputy commissioner, you have to see a patwari or a tehsildar. And the question is, what is it that we have done in terms of their improving their qualifications, in terms of career progression, in terms of also giving them some decent skills? And that is where if you know somebody, if you have the right connections in terms of your caste, you are able to get things done. And not, here, the being grahi or being baradri wala is helpful. Because these street-level bureaucrats also have enormous discretionary power. If they are nice and if you're caught and they say, okay, you have violated the red light, but I let you go this time. You see, so that way, it's something which we need to really really think through, that we need to really have a holistic view of training, not only for the higher civil service, but also for the lower cadres. And in that context now, given 18th Amendment, we have also to think in terms of provincial bureaucracies. And how do you integrate the federal and the provincial and also the local, which is now a real challenge. And since there is a serious lack of coordination in all these, no holistic view, nobody is really looking at the entirety. Therefore, there are serious lacunas and gaps which are becoming more visible. And the way you could pass an order from top to bottom is no longer working. And that is why politicization of the services and of the entire public service is a serious challenge. And there's a need to depoliticize, professionalize, and make it merit-driven and ensure that there is a sense of
tenure. Very interesting. You've used three or four terms that are extremely important. One is independence of the civil service. Two is depoliticization, which is part of independence. Three is merit, which is very important. And four very important word also that you use is professionalization. Yeah. I'll come back to this phase. When the civil service, I mean, as I said, you've written a lot about it. I've learned a lot from your writings. When the civil service was made in, this is now a matter of history, and you remember that famous book, yeah. Men Who Ruled India,
Men
and
there are a few India,
other people who have written about the history of the British civil service. A young kid right now is writing about it too. Yeah. The point is that the civil service in India was really formed as a colonial service to maintain order for the colonials to be able to conduct their trade in peace. And you pointed out that they were really an apolitical force for the colonial masters. Now the point is, as time has gone by, we have adopted that civil service, as you said, Bhutto did some reform. But the two or three things that I think that are missing, as you said, one is the depoliticization, right? In fact, Bhutto may have politicized it more than necessary. And then there were those famous purges that kind of politicized civil. But there's another thing there. What about the fact professionalization? I think the needs of the colonial government were such that all you had to do was maintain law and order and a bit of property rights and contract enforcement. But the needs of development, like education, healthcare, like managing the energy system, managing the water system, all those things were not there. And then with the expanding population, now think about it for me, how should we have responded? We've got a population, I think at the time of independence, we had a population of 20 million. Today, we've got about 200 and something million. Yeah. Should we reconfigure our civil services in somewhat different way because of the needs of the population, needs of development?
These are both very, very important questions. And let me take the last one first. Yes, I tend to see today, population has to be seen and taken in as a core national issue. The way demographic features of Pakistan's population are changing, according to latest census, we have a population of 65% less than the age of 30, which is significant. So that means those
which
who
is huge.
To, it is
youth
huge. So that means those who had to be born, they are already here. The question is, which you are again raising, what is it that we are doing with them? So therefore, from my perspective, it is not simply a fertility, mortality or family planning issue, which is very significant, and there's a need to pay adequate attention towards it. But what is more important, which you keep asking, education, health, housing, other things, what are we doing to impart and improve the skills of those who are already here? So that's a very scary kind of trend. As a consequence of this, and that's why I say population is a core national issue. We have to ask ourselves, are we going to produce uncivilized, uneducated, illiterate, and militant or religiously driven or belief driven kind of a new generation? Or are we willing to invest in education, in improving skills, in inculcating civic virtues in our young people? And that is something which again is really missing. So if one is making a case, one will make a case of how do you sort of bring in the very idea of civics and civics and citizenship in the Pakistani context, so that you are able to really move forward. Now, that's one part where there is a greater need that we need to have an effective long-term both provincial as well as national policy perspectives on this, and there is a need for a conversation and debate, and I'm glad that you're raising this, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But the second question, which was again colonial, and here I say that all institutions that we have today are basically a product of colonial
legacies.
The colonial legacies. So if you have to really look at this, it is, you know, the legal system that we inherited is basically from 1860 to 1935 Act. You see, and we can go back to the earlier times also, okay, and sort of put things together, you know, whether it was the Mughal rule, what was it that was happening, how were they ruling, but the impact and the inheritance and the functioning that we have, and in many ways the idealism that we had is basically rooted in this legal framework that we inherited. And in this legal framework, we have done little to really reform this. You know, all Police Act is still 1860, and it's only in 2002 and 2010 that we have seen little bit of reform. Similarly, you go back to, you know, all the other acts, whether it is blasphemy law and you know, other laws which came into existence between 1978 and 1988, all acts of omission and commission which were done under the martial law regime are part of that. So therefore, we have just tinkered with the law, and that means you know, we have to really seriously review some of the laws which were really good for colonial governance, but there are laws that we need to change.
There's a huge problem here. Who's going to do it?
Yes.
I mean, our politicians, as you pointed out, are incapable of doing it.
Yeah.
Our civil service, I have sympathy for them too.
Yeah.
They are also stretched. There are not that many of them, and they can't deal with the needs of the increasing population.
Yeah.
At the same time, we've got another problem. Our academia is not rising to the challenge of developing enough research and thoughts on this.
Yeah.
So I think we are kind of failing in the fact that there's no national conversation on such vital subjects that you're raising.
No, you are very right. But you see, then, you know, give academia the legitimacy that it deserves. Infuse some degree of professional association. There was a time when we had history association, political science association. Now, one can name only one or two. There is only one for the economists, which is really good. And then, of course, population is the second one. But no professional organization really exists where you meet every year, or at least twice a year, or whatever the time period may be. So that's one which is essential. Number two, you have to think in terms of giving some degree of support to social sciences and humanities as disciplines which are needed to have some
basically
understanding.
Let's put it this way: the government doesn't give any funding for such research.
For such research, because you see, people think that we know our society too well. My sense is we don't know. Therefore, there is a need to really go out in the field. Most of us academics have never been out in the field, except that those who have gone abroad and they have come back to do some field work because that is required. Otherwise, that's a serious handicap, and that is something which we are trying to promote here at the center. That we want some of our research to really go out and do field work and have some understanding in the process. You learn, and therefore you can sort of synthesize and see this. So you're right, the challenges are huge, but
also
some beginning has to be made.
Let me turn you towards another direction too. I mean, I take your point. I think you're absolutely spot on. The tragedy is we have not invested enough in terms of understanding our society.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the government for a short while. You've known the government much longer than I have. Sitting in Islamabad, I used to say all the time, hey, what do I know about Quetta?
Yeah.
What do I know about, Lorelei? Whatever, Jamshoro.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, there's local solution. But I want to raise another question with you. Our civil service structure is a very centralized structure.
Yeah.
When a guy starts off, he starts off in the local government. He's like sub-magistrate or whatever, rises to DC, commissioner. Then he joins the provincial government. Then he joins the federal government. In a sense, it's the same official, so it's the same service. So I don't think we have any local service or any provincial service. We only have one service that runs through the country, which is the backbone of the country. And that service is run by a very small group of people. In your mind, what role would a decentralization play in civil service? Should we have a decentralized, like the way I look at it in the US or in England, now they've got decentralization. Yeah. You know, the local service, yeah. Like the civil service of London is not the same as the civil service of Britain.
Very right. I think, you know, we have had a civil service which is extremely centralized. And now what is happening is, and particularly, which is very recent, 18th Amendment onwards, there is a kind of a trend towards decentralization, which is again not very well thought out. But sheer circumstances are really forcing it. So if you look at the federal civil service, and when we think of, all the time when we think of federal, we are basically looking at two services. One is the now known as Pakistan Administrative Service, mm-hmm. which was previously DMG and still previously CSP. Mm-hmm. So these are the ones who are in the field district, and these are the ones mm-hmm. who are working both at the provincial as well as at the federal level. So when you look at this, and then there is the PSP, the third service, which is sort of seen as federal, is Foreign Service of Pakistan, but I'll leave that for 1 second. But these are two crucial services, and these are services which are basically sort of loaned to the provinces, because law and order is primarily a provincial subject. And, one way to control through the center was that, you have the key positions really controlled through the centralized service. Second, which is equally important, that you look at the very nature of the higher civil service, and particularly these services, they are again regulated by the federal government. That is, either you send officers or the officers are sought by the provinces. Okay, so in some way, formal approval of the federal government is needed. Now it is changing because the provinces are becoming more assertive. And as a result, what you're seeing is that the provincial services are also now demanding and saying that, we need to have, because we have also come through a competitive process. It's a process whereby we may be in our promise, but we have a right to have the highest position in the province. So one has to think in terms of what kind of career progression. Are you offering similar opportunities to the CSS and the PCS? And if you are not, you are creating again some kind of bickering within the services. So you are likely to see this tension which is appearing. But my sense is that with 18th Amendment, now you are likely to see the rise of provincial service. Each province will invest and would like to see some degree of support, and the value of provincial service will also happen. So this means that there's a need to really rethink at the federal level. And as I see it, one has to think in terms of, finance, economic affairs, defense, security, and functions related to currency, they should be with the federal government. Again, going back to what happened in 1971. So, you have to really think in terms of what is it that the federal government should have. So in that sense, again, you will need a professional civil service. You will need to put so that they are able to plan. They are able to sort of not feel insecure in front of a economist or other professionals. They should be able to interact. And that is what it is. And now what is equally interesting, that there are a number of PhDs in the civil services. You see, so if I were to say that if you were to look at the civil service of Pakistan today, much more number is qualified as a and has a degree from abroad. And has that really improved service? So I'm raising this issue that getting a degree may be one of the sort of ideals. If it doesn't improve the service quality and delivery of service, that's a challenge, and I need to really think through this. Hmm. And it's a critical question.
Very important. Yeah. But see, there are two other areas that are suffering because of the centralization. Two important areas. Think about it. As I said, our population at the time of independence was probably 20 million or something, right? Even less maybe. Today, the population of Lahore is 11 million.
Yes.
Right? Population of Karachi is 15 million, right?
Yeah.
And there are several cities that are over a million now, right? I think that these cities, Lahore, for example, is suffering because Lahore does not have its own government, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially Lahore does not have its own bureaucracy.
Yeah.
For example, city planning.
Yeah.
Is a bureaucratic function, a local bureaucratic function, bureaucratic function of the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I go to, for example, places like Faisalabad or places like Rawalpindi or places like Multan, they're a mess. Gujranwala looks like a battle zone because it's just being run so badly.
Right.
At the same time, we are spreading these cities out into a sprawl.
Right.
You're getting this.
Right.
Lahore is going from Kasur to Sialkot, which is totally unmanageable.
Yeah.
Unless we have a local bureaucracy, can we solve this issue? The second point is also very important.
Yeah.
Regulation. Regulation was not an important subject in the past.
Yeah.
Now, for example, NEPRA, PEMRA, there are hundreds of regulatory agencies that are even HEC, etc.
Yeah.
Should they be a part of the civil service? Should they be separate? How should we manage these two issues?
Right. There are three issues, and these are critical issues that you're really raising. I was hesitant to talk about local government, but let me now openly say a few things. Number one, the Local Government Ordinance 2001 was a step in the right direction. It devolved and it really facilitated the rise of local government, and it really, in some ways, I would say, empowered the local government and the citizen. Part of the difficulty was that it was never owned by the promises because the promises were bypassed.
Yeah.
So when the 18th Amendment happens, and as the civil governments come to power in 2008, they come back. Particularly, the provincial governments come back with vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And they come back with vengeance in the sense that now you have what is called 2013 Local Government Acts. And if you look at all the three promises, Sindh is still struggling, KP, Balochistan, and Punjab, all three have basically revived the commissionerate system that has gone back to the old colonial system, because the provincial leadership is equally undemocratic and has a orientation which is centralizing. Therefore, they would like to have a local government which is directed by the chief minister, who is able to clearly direct the commissioner and the deputy commissioner, without recognizing that their powers have been diluted over a period of time, and their dignity and respect has also been undermined. And yet, they are still, trying to revive.
And the cities
have grown into giant institutions. And we have done a study on Lahore. Lo and behold, I was surprised to find, which is again something important, that Lahore has now 10 towns, 2 cantonments, and 1 LDA. So this means, all these, and you are rightly pointing out, 11 million plus, 1 crore population is a huge population. And unless you really let them and think about their own area and bring a larger plan from above and think in terms of integration, then there is a possibility, not otherwise. So local government, local empowerment is the key. And for that, now you have to think in terms of local government. Previously, too, the local government did exist, but a local government officer could rise only up to 19th grade. Now, once again, it is going to change, because local government official is going to be in competition with the provincial. And therefore, you have to really think of, how are you likely to inform? And in that sense, the role of provincial public service commissions, reviving them, keeping their integrity will be of equal importance. Unfortunately, what has happened is, and if you look at Punjab Public Service Commission, it has become a den of retired civil servants and a few retired generals. So, unless you have a broader, larger, and more representative kind of public service commission, you cannot really infuse confidence in people, but one of the key concerns that we have is that people want to get into a government job. You see, because they are thinking more in terms of longevity of service, not in terms of welfare of citizens. So that has to change. And for that, you need to invest in making a call that public service is a calling. And it is an honor to serve people. And that you are choosing a profession whereby you will be contributing, whether the promise, the local, or the national level. And that is something which has to be sort of sent out as strongly as one can.
And what about regulation?
Regulation is equally important, but regulation has to be more or less autonomous bodies, which means, it is not where we have again in Punjab, the model is that through section 42, you create companies and you create authorities. Now, all these authorities in one way or the other are directly under the secretary. You see, which is again an anomaly. So, or if you put in an authority or in a company, 3 to 4 civil servants, that is again going to undermine. So if you're thinking through and are talking in terms of so-called private-public partnership, there has to be some balance between the two. It's not like 80% should be public sector and 20% private sector. And there, the private sector also has to show some degree of credibility, because they are basically looking for subsidies, unfortunately.
So, Dr. what I hear from you then
is, what I hear is that the governance structure now has to be very complex.
Yeah.
We can no longer run it in the sense that one civil servant and, centralized,
yeah.
etc.
Yeah.
So we have to decentralize it in many ways. Local governments, regulatory systems, autonomous bodies,
yeah.
even I would say, I think you would agree, that universities should be independent.
Absolutely.
Too, should not be answerable to the secretary.
Yeah. Or even to the HEC should have limited
exactly.
regulatory power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we need to develop complex governance structures
yeah.
of a modern era, which
yeah.
other countries have done. It's
yeah.
not as if
yeah.
we don't
no?
know.
No. Yeah.
Other countries have done. So we need to develop these systems where you have some citizen participation, like
yeah.
universities have citizen boards,
yeah. Yeah.
regulatory bodies have citizen
yeah.
boards, you have more citizen participation, less centralized government participation. But let me finally ask you two questions, maybe one question, simple, that in this complex system, what role will what we call the civil service play, and how should that civil service be recruited and trained? So just address that briefly, and then
yeah,
obviously we can carry
this
much further.
Yeah,
further
yeah, no, that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
The recruitment of civil service has to change at all three levels:
mm-hmm.
local, provincial, and federal.
Mm-hmm.
In case of federal civil service, we need to really think in terms of maybe reducing the number of services from 12. To 4 or 5, which should be basically federal civil services, and I can name them, but not at this at this point. That you need basically good quality professional service, which is able to.
You already named them,
yeah,
and you said
yeah,
that the
yeah,
functions
yeah,
that
yeah,
the federal
yeah,
government should perform.
Yeah,
so according yeah, to that.
So
yeah.
so the basic task of the federal government should be that it should have a civil service which can give you a sense of a vision, a broad thrust of policies, and long-term vision, which is very, very important. And for that, we do have, motivated, interested young people who are joining it. By the time they reach that level, they can really contribute very effectively in that. So that's one. In other words, we need to think in terms of creating a critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can start, if we are looking at the existing structure, from grade 19 to onwards. Okay, and that takes about 10 years, not at the grade 22,
yeah.
when somebody is about to retire. So you start at 19 and you have about 10 years, you see.
Sure.
So if you are able to create that, that would be really good. And the as far as the provincial services are concerned, we need to strengthen the Provincial Public Service Commission, as we need to strengthen the Federal Public Service Commission. It is a constituent. It's a constitutional body which should be completely independent. You see, which it is not. Therefore, there's a need to make this independent, autonomous, and again increase and diversify the representation of these both federal and provincial public service institutions. Number two, when you think of training, training has to be sort of linked with prospects of career and promotion, and that again is missing. And then training has to be a comprehensive exercise that whereby we are thinking of the street level bureaucrat and also at the highest level. And there's a need to draw a distinction that, you know, at the mid-career level and at the highest level, what is it that we are going to do? At the mid-career level, you can still impart skills. And the focus has to be on skill orientation, change in attitude, outlook. And again, that means investing in trainers, investing in bringing people who are qualified, who have background from outside, from inside, who can really restructure the nature of the training institution. And at the higher level, the focus has to be basically on how do you deal with policies, how do you really improve governance part, and how do you go about really interacting with the national, international donors, agencies, so that you are in a position whereby you can contribute towards that. And finally, unless the civil services itself begins to think in terms of putting value in the training institutions, nothing is likely to change. And whether one likes it or not, the military does it a little better. That is why they have a better training facility, organization, institution, because they combine instruction, staff, and operation, or command, as they put it. These three things. And if you become if you are given a position at the NDU for a war course, which means there is a possibility that you will move from brigadier to a major general. In our case, in the case of civil service, it is irrespective of where you are and how you are, your career prospects are not really adversely affected.
Yeah.
And therefore, there is a need to really put some value on that.
Very good. Dr. Saeed Shafkat, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
There is still a lot to be discussed. As I tell all my guests, that the conversation doesn't end here.
Yeah.
I will draw upon you once again. I'll tell you what we need to discuss further. For example, I think we need to discuss the whole human resource management in the public sector.
Yeah.
We need to discuss what policy is. We need to understand.
Yeah.
We need to also discuss what is the role of the civil service in policy making and how should they make policy.
Right.
So I will, for the moment, I think you've given
that's
us a
very kind
hell of a lot to
yeah,
to
not
think
it has
about.
Been a real treat talking
my
to you.
My last question, which I ask all my guests.
Yeah.
Can you please recommend a book, a movie, or whatever you think that, as I said, my audience, I think, is the youth, the students who are studying. What would you recommend for them to either read or watch? What do you think?
For Pakistan, I will suggest people to look at this book by Anatole Levien.
Okay.
In Pakistan,
a hard country,
right? It's an interesting, sympathetic view on Pakistan and may inspire some. And for the global audience, I think there's plenty which is coming on China.
Okay.
So watch China, and there is a lot of work which is going to challenge the democratic setups and also the very idea of bureaucracy as we have understood it. So one can make a case in that sense.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This was wonderful. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.